Welcome to the No BS Spiritual Book Club's live streaming interview series, where leading New Thought teachers, speakers, and authors share the intimate stories behind the 10 best spiritual books that inspired them the most on their spiritual journey. From well-known classics to hidden gems you might never have heard of, the No BS Spiritual Book Club saves you time and money by sharing reliable recommendations from those who've walked the path before you. The No BS Spiritual Book Club, the only No BS guide to the best spiritual books to inspire your own journey of self-discovery. Here's your host, founder of the No BS Spiritual Book Club, Sandy Sedgbeer.
Hello and welcome, and joining me today to share the stories behind the 10 books that influenced her the most on her life journey is social change adventurer, activist, author, and teacher, Fabiana Fondavidia. Fabiana is a former journalist, writer, and columnist for some of the primary newspapers and magazines in Latin America, where she interviewed world-renowned thinkers, philosophers, mystics, and scientists before deciding to shift gears and begin a hands-on, heart-first, personal exploration. Over the last 10 years, Fabiana has led year-long courses, both online and face-to-face, which takes students on a personal and communal adventure of growth and discovery, challenging themselves to come ever closer to being the change that they wish to see in the world. Fabiana's latest book is Where Wonder Lives, Practices for Cultivating the Sacred in Your Daily Life, and it's the first of her books to be published in English. Fabiana Fondavidia, welcome.
Thank you so much, Sandy. Such a pleasure to be here.
I love your glasses, Fabiana. They're so cool.
Thank you so much. And thank you for that beautiful introduction.
So tell us what books mean to you and how you coped with having to distill your most influential spiritual books down to just 10 titles.
Well, that wasn't easy at all. But at the same time, it was very fun because it gave me a good excuse to spend an entire day with my library, just going through it and making decisions and going round and round trying to decide who made it to that top 10 list. And of course, I don't feel I was fair to all of the authors that I so love, but again, I had to make a choice. As with many people probably watching, I am a big fan of books and they have made such a huge impact in my life, especially spiritual books, because that is my calling. And I have found them a reliable way to get close to those authors that have experiences similar to mine and that have been able to channel some of that energy, not just their ideas, but also their hearts into these books. And so finally, I chose the ones that I've found myself going back to again and again. I think those are the ones that have become the most faithful companions on my journey.
And did you put your list in chronological order?
No. I'm more of a spontaneous kind of person in all things. So I pretty much just went with, well, the first two really there was no contest there. I think of, if I may already start talking about the first two books, Joseph Campbell on the one side and Mary Oliver on the other, I think of as a kind of spiritual mother and father. They've been luminaries in my life, each in their specific genre. And so I really didn't have to give that much, a lot of thought. They were clearly going to be at the top because of the enormous difference they've made in my life. Again, in different ways, because Campbell, if I may start to talk about him, Joseph Campbell, I know I'm definitely not alone in saying this, has been one of those before and after figures, not only because of the ideas that he so elegantly put forth in his books and in his talks. It's really worth, if somebody hasn't heard him talk, it's so worth going to look for, at least for The Power of Myth, which is really the book that I recommended in its original form, which was an interview, and it's available on YouTube in little fragments. So that interview, which really opened up so many people's eyes to what myths really were about. And even more than that, because he wasn't a theorist, he was a pragmatist and a person who was very much alive in his ideas. These ideas were his not just his passion as a thing, as something to study, but as a way to a credo, a creed to live by, you could say. Mm. So listening to him speak and transmit the energy that he found in these ancient myths was really quite contagious and inspiring and energy and life affirming. So first I heard him speak. I remember a conference that somebody passed on to me, and I listened to it in the car. I still remember the time, because the whole ride I was thinking, I have to stop. I have to stop and listen to this man, because something is happening here and it's not just another conference. And I think I did in fact stop, even though I was in the middle of a very busy road, and I just took in what was happening. And from then on, it was just been a nonstop feast of rereading him and quoting him and teaching about his ideas. And this is my favorite book, because all of them are so valuable, but this one is him being himself in conversation and opening up his world, his inner world, his life, his advice. And of course, being a journalist myself, I love interviews and conversations and the kinds of things that happen when people think out loud, you know, and in the moment. So this whole book is a gem to me. The questions, Bill Moyer's questions, are also amazing. So, and he comes from such a different place, being a Christian man and with a completely different outlook. So all of it is just, they're really making each other shine the whole time. So this is a book I strongly recommend people read.
I've heard of people saying that the books, their favorite books, the ones that meant the most to them, were their teachers. I don't think I've heard anybody say they were like their spiritual parents.
Oh, yeah, definitely. For me, it's more than teachers, because I do feel that spirituality for me is an experience more than anything else. It's not so much an idea, or you can put words to it, but the words are never on a par with the emotions. And it's very much an emotional affair for me. And that's why I'm drawn to these two characters in particular, these two authors, because they were so alive in their spirituality, in their way of living, in their way of relating to the world, and even to the world of ideas. So when I read them, that spark immediately connects, and I don't even feel that it's a, I speak to them often, I do. So,
You said that reading this and hearing his voice was a life-changing event, and you said it all began with this oft-quoted line, people say that what we're all seeking is a meaning for life. I don't think that's what we're really seeking. I think that what we're seeking is an experience of being alive. Now, that really shook you. Why did it shake you so much?
Because I was one of those people that he's talking about trying to find the meaning of life. And I did think there was something there that you could uncover, like an idea or a secret of some kind, or a truth, an ultimate truth that would make everything else fall into place. And that's, you know, when I read and when I wrote and when I interviewed all those people you were mentioning before, I had the privilege as a journalist to talk to very, very important, interesting thinkers. And the whole time I was trying to find some kind of an answer. And reading that, there was that instant spark of recognition. It's not an answer, because it's not an idea. It's not in my mind. I will never find it there, intellectual though one may be, one may feel. I was brought up by very intellectual parents, so that was naturally my road, you know, the scholarly road. But then again, that's not where I really vibrated with all of these experiences. That's why I got into ritual, because ritual is a way of bringing the sacred or the spiritual into our everyday lives, into the world. So when I heard him say that, I thought, of course, then stop looking in those places and start living, and just keep finding it as you go along, in nature, in relationships, all those other paths that he was so familiar with.
Mm. Now, your second book, which is, I guess, your spiritual mother, Mary Oliver, you describe this book as a thin little creature, but one in which you found your home and never left. So say more about that.
Well, I'm not sure that was the first one I read by her, but it was definitely the one that really got me. I don't know. There's something about the way that she, I guess it was a time that she was going through. I'm not sure, but I think it was when her wife, her beloved Molly, was dying and was sick. So there's a lot of angst and a lot of a lot of heart in that book, and she's very bare and very vulnerable. And she writes about her usual subjects, which is nature and her dogs and her relationship with her beloved. But there's an angst. There's a feeling of life becoming urgent and her having to make good decisions. And all of that is so well portrayed in that book. And there's a line at the end. Let me see if I can remember it exactly. She says, it's like an epilogue, and she says to God, love of the world and love of you are having such a long conversation in my heart. And I was also taken by that line, and I felt so reflected by it. Often I have felt that way, you know, torn between different loves and all and each of them having their claim over my heart. So I guess that's that line really did it for me. But there's a lot, there's many poems in that. For example, that's the book that has Messenger, which is one of my all-time Mary Oliver favorites, which talks about our work being to be in awe and in gratitude, just standing still and learning to live in gratitude. I almost don't remember them in English so well now because I've translated them and I've read them in Spanish so many times that the first version that comes into my mind is in Spanish. I have to think back to the original, but that poem Messenger. And then there's another one which I also was fascinated by in that book, which is called Preparing the House for the Lord. And this is very strange because I'm not a religious person. I don't think in terms of the Lord. I don't have a personal God, an image of God. But the whole poem, which is basically talks about preparing her house to let in, getting her house, making her house hospitable to all the critters and wildlife that wants to get in, including mice in her kitchen cupboards. And she's talking about making room for all of them to come in. And then in the end, she says something like, so I know you know that I'm talking to you when I say all day and all morning and all afternoon, come in, come in. And that gets to me still, that final two lines, that verse, because that's what her poems are about. It's pure celebration. She's a celebratory poet. And I couldn't feel more at one with her in that respect.
Hmm. So your third book is one about which you say, whenever anyone disenchanted with religion or suffering a crisis of faith asks me to recommend a different approach to spirituality, this is where I send them. And the book is The Care of the Soul, How to Add Depth and Meaning to Your Everyday Life by Thomas More, published in 1998.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is an absolute classic for me. And the reason is not only because it's so well written and so deep and luminous, but also because he shares a kind of spirituality that was also an eye-opener for me, pretty much because that's how I felt about spirituality, but I thought I was alone. I thought there was nobody else out there who had the same approach. Most spiritual books are of the transcendent kind, so they propose the two diverging paths, not diverging, actually they're complementary, but there's two like basic orientations in spirituality, the ascendant or transcendent path and the descendant path. And ascending path is the one that takes us from the world of forms to the source. And so the idea is to leave the world of forms and feelings and emotions and sexuality and all else behind in order to connect with the source. So a lot of the basic religions and meditations have this quality. And there's not so much to be found of the descending path, which is how do we find the sacred here in the crops that you're caring for, in the animals and in the things that happen to you every day in your life. And this book was a revelation in that way, in that sense, because that's what this book is about. It's about an everyday kind of spirituality, very much, very far from any solemnity. And also it's a way of the soul rather than of the spirit. So souls are very much incarnate creatures. So they're very much at home in this world with our faults and fears and intuitions and dreams and visions and mythic imagination. And all of that, which is very much my world as well, is what he majestically writes about throughout that book and the many that followed, because you know there's a whole series of Care of the Soul books, but this was the first, and to me it's still the one to go to when you're in need of some spiritual nutrition.
And he actually wrote the foreword for your book, Where Wonder Lives. How did you manage to pull that off?
I don't know still. It wasn't actually the foreword. The foreword was by another major love of mine, which is Brother David Steindl-Rast. What he wrote was an endorsement.
An endorsement.
And it was just absolutely, of course, I cried when I received his email. I wrote it after much thought, thinking, how can I dare to do this? But I had interviewed him, I don't know, 20 years ago when I first started reading him. I was a journalist. I interviewed him. I remember him being very polite and very nice, but I never had any contact with him again. And I was sure he wouldn't remember me, of course. So it was really just a very bold move on my part. And I hadn't heard from him again, which is what I expected. And I remember I had to send the blurbs, the endorsements to the publisher. And there was like one more day. And I said, I'm just going to ask him just, you know, to be on the safe side that he got the email. So I said, I'm sorry to bother you again. I just want to know if you received it. And he said, I was just about to send you this endorsement. And he said, he started out by saying something like, this is one of the best books I've read in. And I almost couldn't read anymore because I started crying, and I had to have my husband read the rest of it. I said, tell me that he says something good because it starts out really well. So yes, I'm incredibly grateful and fond of him for doing that. And we've stayed in touch. We correspond. He's an amazing person as well as an amazing author. But even if he hadn't done any of this, I would still be saying, you have to read this book.
Yeah. So book number four, Writing Down the Bones, Freeing the Writer Within by Natalie Goldberg. And this was published in the mid-80s. So tell us about this one.
Well, I had some doubts about this one only because it's such a popular book. And I thought maybe I should be recommending books that people don't know about. But I just couldn't leave it off the list because it was so, it's really a darling for me. I've written, like many people, vocationally since I was a kid. I wrote diaries from the time when I was 8 years old. But I think I really did need her permission, her specific, her very heartful kind of permission that she gave so many people to start writing without feeling like I had to be, I don't know, some specially trained or talented or scholarly writer. And the way she did that was so charming because I don't know if you read the book, but it's basically written in cafes, which is another thing that got to me because that's how I like to write. And she shares her writing advice and her encouragement to write in such a, as if you were sitting down across the table from her and listening to a friend tell you, come on, stop wasting your time. Let's write. So 10 minutes. Your first memory of your father, and go. And that's how she would write. And it was so fresh and spontaneous and delectable. And I also really enjoyed the image of her writing in Santa Fe, which is where she was at the time. And I've always wanted to go. I hope I will before I die, just because of the memories that are associated with her writing, overlooking those amazing landscapes in those cafes.
So why do you like writing in cafes?
That's a good question. I've never been able to explain it to my husband. He always says, it's noisy, it's busy, you have a perfectly good place at home. And all of that's true. But I think I like to look out the window and I like the feeling of movement and people coming in and out and the smell of coffee brewing and just the general atmosphere of people being going about their lives. I like to watch people. I don't know if there's something there.
So did Natalie Goldberg's book give you the impetus to write your own books? I mean, you were already a journalist, so you were writing, but of course, writing your own books is a different kind of writing. Was it she that gave you permission to do that, in a sense?
Well, I'm not sure that it was that direct. She gave me a lot of inspiration to keep writing. That definitely happened. But I started publishing my books, in fact, when I had children, and I had written children's books for my own children. And I guess that was a door that I could walk in. You know, for some reason, I don't want to be disrespectful to children's literature, which I adore, but it seemed a little bit less, I don't know, vulnerable to publish those children's stories. So that's really how I got into the actual publishing adventure. That's how that began. But I had been writing for my entire life. And she did give me the courage and also the kick in the butt, if I may say so, to stop stalling and saying, no, I'm not inspired. And maybe the perfect idea hasn't come along. That's what she's great at. It's just telling you, if you're a writer, you just need to write. That's all you need to do. And she's unmatched in that respect.
Mm, Yeah. So did you find any inspiration from Julia Cameron as well? Have we got a problem with the sound there? Did you hear me?
No, I'm sorry. Could you repeat that?
Yes. I'm wondering whether you found any inspiration from Julia Cameron. You mention her in relation to this particular book. You said that years before Julia Cameron's The Way of the Artist liberated blocked or frustrated creatives, Natalie Goldberg had already set us free to spill our guts and our visions on the page. I love that description, by the way. But did you also get inspiration from Julia?
Yes, not as directly. I loved her book too, mostly because of the way she related creativity with spirituality and how she pretty much, there's a line, I think it's by her, although Elizabeth Gilbert says pretty much the same thing, but it's this idea of telling God or whatever universal force you believe in, I'll take care of the quantity, you take care of the quality, so to speak, you know, letting yourself open to whatever comes and not feeling so responsible for writing greatness. That's something that Julia does very well. And in her unblocking practices all have to do with allowing some bigger force to write through you and to get its message across. That was helpful for me.
Mm. Good. Yes, I interviewed Julia some time ago, and her books have been wildly popular. And I think they've helped many, many people realize that they can write.
Right.
And they don't have to be scared of it.
Right. And especially because she doesn't just talk to writers, as Natalie does, but it's for any kind of creative. So I'm sure she's unblocked not just writers, but musicians and actors. And she's amazing at that. Yeah. Mm. She's very free.
So book number 5, A New Republic of the Heart, An Ethos for Revolutionaries by Terry Patton. You say that this is for those of us who are frightened and dismayed at the state of the world. So tell me more about that.
Terry's another one of my favorite authors because of how committed he is to what he does. He's always been that way. I've interviewed him many times when I was a journalist. And well, we're all aware of what's happening, and at times we tend to deny and to change channels because it seems hopeless at times, and it can be so dismaying. And so a lot of the times we feel like there's very little we can do, and everything seems to be in the hand of countries and corporations and politicians, but he tells a different story. He is more, he's the kind of thinker I like. He's a hands-on thinker, and he's a hopeful thinker, and he basically lays out the first half of the book is an excellent, brilliant analysis of where we are and how we got here. And the second half is a roadmap to how we can turn things around. And I also feel very close to him in his vision because he is at heart, he's an optimist. He's a life lover, and he's devoted his life to helping people wake up. I'm not a fan of the term wake up, but you know, come to their senses and come to a life of the heart. And so the way he combines these two challenges, how to have a rich inner life while at the same time pouring out that those discoveries and that wisdom and that insight into helping the world evolve, that's not something you see every day. It's that loop, which is exactly what I'm trying to teach in my courses, because it's what I think is the call of the times, is how to make that transition, or that, yeah, it's like an infinity between inner work and outer work in the world, because you really can't, we don't have the luxury to just do inner work anymore the way things are. It's the same as some environmentalist writers or nature writers are saying, we can't just write poems of adoration to nature because there won't be any more nature if we don't do something to fight for it. So we've all sort of been forced to become activists, but I do think there's a lot of wisdom and a lot of need to have those two spheres join. There's been a lot of spiritual writers that have not concerned themselves up until now with the world. They've left it to the politicians and the activists, and there's activists who haven't done a lot of inner work, so a lot of their initiatives are lacking a little bit of depth, and we do need those two spheres, I think, to join and to feed off each other. And that's what Terry does brilliantly in his book, is to combine those two spheres. And he's an integral theorist, an integral philosopher. So he does it with a lot of, not just a lot of depth, but a lot of span. He brings in information and insight from all kinds of disciplines. It's a gem. That book is a gem. Yeah.
So he did some work with Ken Wilber, didn't he?
Yes. They started out, but he has a long trajectory of his own. And since then, he's created a whole community of people working with his ideas, and he's undergoing a health challenge at the moment, which he's been very outspoken about. And it's very moving for me and all the people that admire him and appreciate him, the way he's really walking his talk. It's you don't get to see that every day. He's living this experience with the same consistency and transparency that he's always done everything. And it's just, it's very awe-inspiring to watch him.
So did you find, as you were reading these books, and, you know, we don't know the order in which you read them, but each one of them left a real big mark on you, or kind of motivated, or, you know, leapfrogged you to another level of understanding about something?
Right. Yes. They did so in different ways. Some of them brought in a new piece of the puzzle, so to speak, and others were more like finding a really good friend or a really good sister or brother along the way, and finding confirmation. And you know how we like to stick together, people who are the same, I don't know what the word would be, affiliation. Yeah. So some of them, like in Mary's books, Mary Thompson Reynolds, right? She and I had spoken a few times over an interview or another, and I was delighted with her book, and I found myself so reflected in her, the model that she designs of these archetypes. Sorry, I skipped ahead. Is that okay?
Okay. Carry on.
Her book is about the five archetypal, that's how she calls them, the five archetypal landscapes of the earth. So it's oceans and rivers, deserts, prairies, woods, and mountains. And this is her own construction. These archetypes are, of course, they live in the collective unconscious, but we can all group them in a certain way or make them out. There's different ways that we can approach archetypes, and this is her way. She's a nature writer and a nature lover, and so she discovered how much we have in common with these basic essential landscapes. And since I am a nature devotee myself, I found myself very reflected in all of these ideas, and I found it very intriguing that we might find a lot of connections with landscapes that we've never actually visited, such as deserts. I haven't been in a lot of, I don't know if I've ever been in a desert actually, but when you read about the starkness, for example, the Santa Fe deserts that I've read through Natalie Goldberg's books are very familiar to me, almost as if I'd spent time there myself. So I had no trouble connecting to the kinds of feelings, you know, the starkness and the vulnerability and the openness and the idea of life and death being so out in the open. So the qualities of these landscapes and the fact that we can access them through our soul, through our soul's eyes, and not necessarily traveling them there, I found that very exciting. And I shared it with my students, and I found everybody was excited by this idea. And one of the reasons I included it, aside from the fact that I love the book and I love the author, is that right now with the coronavirus and the fact that we're all staying at home, or we've been staying at home for so long, I thought it was a timely thought that we don't need to travel in order to connect with other parts of the world. They live inside us already, especially where nature is concerned, because we are part of it and it is part of us. So we can seek out the inner desert, the inner woods, the inner mountaintop without moving geographically to see them with our own eyes. Yeah.
It is interesting how different landscapes impact you. You know, people talk about loving the sea. Most people like being by the ocean. But then you go to the desert, you know, like Arizona or New Mexico, and it's a whole other, you know, kind of starkness and a feeling and an emotional connection that you get. You know, there's certain places in the world that I think we all just find ourselves wanting to melt into. You know, there's something about them that really supports us and makes us feel good.
Exactly. and they each have these specific qualities, because it's not the same. It's all awe. They're all awe producing landscapes or evoking landscapes, but it's not the same kind of awe that you get from a mountaintop where you're standing above everything and everything is minute, and you get a sense of perspective and dimension. And it's a very different kind of awe when you're standing in a woods surrounded by trees and you're one more amongst the trees, and there's light is filtered through the trees. So there's a lot of darkness, and that brings out other soul qualities that are familiar to us as well. And as you said, the desert with that starkness and the seas and the rivers, I'm also a huge fan, especially of the river, because that's where I have closer to my home. But what Mary did was put words and very clear associations with the kinds of things that the water, the big waters, provoke in us. And one is sensuality, the idea of going back into a body. It's a body of the earth as well, and it's the one we arose from originally. So maybe that's why it's such a sensual experience and such a feeling of, well, literal immersion in something bigger than us. So they're all familiar in different ways, and they all bring out different qualities in us that may not have surfaced if not in the presence of those landscapes, those inner landscapes as well as outer. So I think there's a lot of insight there.
Yes, yes. Much more than just a landscape.
Much more.
Yeah. So the next book is The Smell of Rain on Dust, Grief and Praise by Martin Prechtl.
Prechtl,
yeah.
He's an author that I came across him not so long ago, but I instantly fell in love with him. And the reason I must be honest, and I must say that, well, I was intrigued by the title of the book, but also by the fact that Mary Oliver actually recommends him in the, I guess it's a blurb on the cover. And I've never seen her recommend anything else or even speak about any other authors. She was a very private person. So that instantly caught my eye. And I said, I have to find out who this person is. And I realized that I had read articles by him. I had always been interested in what he had to say. And now I know why, because the book is another gem. What's interesting about Martin is that he is of mixed descent. Do you say mixed?
Mixed race, mixed ancestry.
Ancestry, exactly. So that's the word I was looking for, because he's part Swiss and he has some First Nations blood, but mostly he was raised or he spent a lot of time in Guatemala and in, I think it was also Santa Fe or some place, New Mexico. So he had a lot of contact with traditional native cultures, and he really drank that in to the point that he became some kind of a celebrant. He was appointed a shaman. And so he writes with a foot in both worlds. You know, he is a Western modern thinker, and at the same time, he has that very deep and earthy wisdom. And I have never read anybody speak about grief the way he does. He really takes it to an entirely different level. It's very poetic, but at the same time, very grounded, because what he says in, I'm sorry, Martin, if he ever reads this, I don't want to bring his entire beautiful gem of a book into a one-liner, but if I had to distill all the wisdom that he brings in his book, it's all about how grief is an opportunity, being the other side of love and being an integral part of love, because you cannot grieve what you didn't love.
Yes.
The role, the task of grief is to help us to praise the person who died, the person or the place or whatever it is we've lost. And so it's a call to action. It's not a stagnant, passive state. It's not something that merely leaves us empty, but it calls us to do something with that grief. And at a time when the world is so grief-struck and all of us are in one way or another affected by what's going on, and knowing that even if it's not directly impacting us, there's so many people around us losing loved ones, I think it's such a timely and important message that there is something to be done with our grief other than just suffering. The suffering is almost, I don't want to say the least important, but it's not the main part. Our suffering it's kind of a furnace that cooks us, Martin would probably say, and makes us ready for a higher level of spiritual insight and understanding. But even more than that, it's about love. Grief is love. So the moment that we are grief struck and we can connect with that, and we are socially enabled, not the word, but when socially we're not restricted, and we're not, most of modern society, Western society, pretty much represses grief. Yes. There is not much room for it. There are not many public rituals, and the few that we have are short and sort of ascetic, and they don't give us the space to cry out and to really mourn with others. And grief is a community task, and we've lost that dimension. So just giving us, just as Julia gave us the permission to be creative and Natalie to write without too much concern for quality, he gives us the permission to grieve with our entire bodies, with our entire hearts, and as a community. And I think that's a sorely needed message.
Yeah.
And also beautifully written, very, very poetically written.
You wrote that, you know, his message is sobering. If we keep on refusing to grieve, we will be condemned to a way of life predicated to separation and war. Yeah, yeah. We do avoid grief because it's painful, and we tend to avoid pain wherever we can, but we have to embrace all of it.
Right, it's painful, and also we haven't been taught what to do with it. That's yes. also part of it. So when you don't know what to do with something, you repress it because it feels wrong. And since nothing that is repressed goes away, but rather goes into hiding or finds alternate ways of expression, the way pain metabolizes usually when you don't take it into your arms and give it room is into anger and violence. And that's I agree wholeheartedly with Martin that's what we're seeing yes. a lot of the time.
Yeah. Well, it's not a book that I've read, but certainly what you've shared about it makes me want to read this book. It feels like there's something really important there that so there's another dimension that we need to explore that most of us have been ignoring.
Right. And it's also, since it's written from a very, with a lot of cultural insight of a very different culture, I also found that very interesting because we really, it's hard for us to put on another person's way of looking at life and to really make room for a completely different outlook. And that's what he does very beautifully without imposing it on you. He really introduces you into a different mindset and heart space altogether. And he shows you, there's a beautiful example of a woman who's lost her leg, I think it is. And the way she lives without that leg, the way she mourns that loss really brings it home to us that everything can be mourned and everything can make us bigger. Our losses don't need to diminish us. In fact, our losses should make us bigger. Mm. And he really, I think, shows the way to let that happen to us.
So the next book is An End to Upside Down Thinking, Why Your Assumptions About the Material World Are No Longer Scientifically True by Mark Gober.
This is a wholly different kind of book, completely different. This has appealed more to my intellectual side. But I have long believed and experienced the world from the point of view that Mark explains and so many other researchers, which is not as a disparate and separate collection of objects, but rather as a community of interconnected beings and even objects. And the way that modern day science, actually it's not so much modern day science, but materialist science or materialistic science, which is a particular strand of science, has looked at it and has taught science for so many years, really is misleading because it does make us feel like the world is this inert, random, non-intelligent planet filled with mostly non-intelligent and dead things, except for humans and other animals. And more we are learning that is not so. I have been reading research on all what they used to call paranormal activities, and they don't use that word so much anymore because now we know it's normal. It's very normal, and it's just different, and it's just not credited with being real by science. Nevertheless, it happens to most of us, so that should tell us something. And being a dreamer, somebody who writes down her dreams and sometimes rereads them, I have found myself looking ahead a couple of days in my dreams and finding information of what was to come too many times to ignore this and to think that there's nothing going on there. So from my own experience and my own curiosity, I've been reading research on this for many years, decades, I would say. And there's many authors such as Dean Radin and the author of One Mind, Larry Dawsey. There's so many very lucid and learned authors that have written, very evidential, Charles Tart, so many authors. The reason that I pointed out this book, maybe it's because it's the latest to come my way, but also because he made a very strong case of a skeptic, former skeptic, and a person who does not come from this way. He has not been studying this for ages, but when he came across some information, this completely, and first he said, this can't possibly be true. And then he started researching it and he realized that there's all kinds of information and he couldn't make out why this information has been kept from the public in a way, because it's not really published. It's definitely not taught in universities, except for some very minor exceptions. And it doesn't get picked up by scientific journals, except again, in very few cases. So it does seem to be like there's some kind of conspiracy to keep this from us, under the guise of it's too good to be true. We wish it were so, but this is probably wishful thinking. And it turns out it's not. That seems to be more the fabric of reality than the way we've been taught as we grew up. It's not something that is clear cut. We don't know how it works. We don't know exactly how to channel it. All of that is true as well, but it exists and it changes everything, as he says in the book. So I like to give this book to my non-believing friends, to my skeptical friends, because it makes a good case and it's very journalistic, you know, very compact and full of the necessary information. So I think it's a good place to start rather than going to the insiders who share, you know, lengthier research and more detailed information. This is like a very good introduction to this sphere of knowledge.
Yeah. He says that today's disarray around the globe can be linked at its core to a fundamental misunderstanding of our reality. Ain't that the truth?
Yes. I think he puts it wonderfully. And he also includes a lot of quotes by very important people that people don't know, most of us don't know, are endorsing these ideas and are saying, listen, it's time we get this right. We are all one mind and we just feel and act like we are separate individuals and on a different level we are, but at the same time we can tap into that common root, and that does change everything from a different perspective, but in this, aligned with Martin Prechtel's ideas. If we tap into that common heart and into the fact that we are all family at a very deep and basic level, then we also don't need to go towards anger and violence and fear, and we can ground ourselves in something that is closer to the truth of who we are.
Definitely a book for this time, without a doubt. Yeah. Okay, so the next one, I like the title, The Impossible Will Take a Little While, A Citizen's Guide to Hope in a Time of Fear, edited by Paul Boget-Loeb.
Yes.
And this was published in 2004.
Yes, that's a bit more recent, not that recent, but actually I also came across it not that long ago, and I was instantly taken by the title, which is a part of a song by Billie Holiday, I think, sung by Billie Holiday. And it's a collection, it's a brilliant collection of essays on what real hope means. So it's, in a way, it's a little bit more aligned with Terry Patton's book, but it's not so much a roadmap, but a collection of voices of people who throughout times, because there's essays by and speeches by Martin Luther King, and it's not just contemporary voices, but it's very well chosen. So they illuminate different angles. And he has, just to highlight my favorite, he has one, as part of a speech, I think, by Václav Havel, who was the former president of Czechoslovakia, a very brilliant man. And he has the best definition of hope I've ever heard, and I've always taught it from that time on. And that is that hope is not the certainty that something will go well, but the conviction that something is worth doing, that something is worthwhile, no matter how it turns out. So the whole essay deals with hope as an orientation of the heart rather than optimism, which is more, you know, I think it's going to go well. This is so much deeper. And it's very aligned with the that phrase by Martin Luther, not Martin Luther King, the original Martin Luther, that said, you know, if I knew the world would end tomorrow, I would still plant my apple tree, which is, I think, maybe the most beautiful line ever written, because it speaks of that kind of hope. You know, I'm not doing this for myself. I'm not doing this because it's going to benefit me in any way. I'm doing this because this is what's worth doing and because life is worth it. And at a time like this, when it, things are so brave and we are so much in need of that kind of hope, because the other kind of easier hope, optimistic hope, has kind of gone down the drain with the things that one reads and one sees. We really can't fool ourselves into thinking there's going to be an easy fix. Nevertheless, we have to keep working, right? We have to keep doing. We have to keep finding more reasons for true hope and giving each other reasons to keep doing what must be done. So I think this book is very necessary, and it's full of good food, good spiritual food, for those of us still in the fight. In accordance with what I was saying before of this idea of spiritual activists, well, actually that's the exact word, spiritual practitioners also being activists right now, because that's what we all need to be doing. It's an all hands on deck kind of time. So I think this book is food for those kinds of spiritual seekers, the ones who want to bring their ideas into action in the world, full of insight, full of gems throughout the book.
And so the last book is My Grandfather's Blessings, Stories of Strength, Refuge and Belonging by cancer physician and master storyteller Rachel Naomi Remen.
Yes, oh, she's a sweetheart. I have not met her. I have not spoken to her ever, but I feel like she's, I don't know, a well-beloved aunt. And I'm sure that many others have felt the same way. She really has a knack for telling it like it is and sharing her own story. She had the good fortune of having this amazing grandfather who was a rabbi, a very learned and insightful man. She was very young when he died, so almost all the memories that he shares are from when she was, I think, 4 or 5 years old, but clearly he had a very big impact on her, and she has the generosity to share it with the world, with those of us who didn't have a rabbi grandfather. And she also, she's a doctor and somebody who suffered a lifelong illness herself, which is Crohn's disease. So she has the perspective of being both a patient and a doctor. And one of the things she's done, which has been marvelous, I think, is to struggle to bring back humanity and vulnerability and humility to the medical profession, which is in dire need of it. And that's what she saw. She tells the story of how in med school she had her vulnerability sort of driven out of her, because that's how they're taught, to leave that out so that they can be effective doctors. And she said, something is wrong here because I don't want to disassociate from my heart, and this is not doing me any good. So she started teaching doctors to be able to withstand, to stand emotions and to stand together with their patients in the fire of uncertainty and difficult diagnosis. And it's just amazing. There's one story, I'm pretty sure it's in that book, because she has two books, as far as I know. I don't know if there's any others. And both of them are beauties. The other one's called Kitchen Table Wisdom. But this is the one that I read most often, the grandfather's blessings. But in either of these books, she tells the story. I'm pretty sure it's in this one. It's a story of her own suffering when she was first diagnosed. And no, actually, she already had Crohn's disease, but something came up and nobody could find what it was. And she kept going from doctor to doctor, and they were all getting sort of impatient with her because nothing came up in the tests, but she had all these weird symptoms. Until she came to this doctor who actually sat with her and took some time and listened very patiently and very respectfully. And when she was done, he said to her, look, I don't know what it is you have, but I will wait with you and I will be attentive with you. And at some point we will find out. I will be with you and we will find out. And she ends the story by saying, and then a month later, when an abscess in my abdomen finally showed up in an x-ray, he was the doctor who did the surgery, performed the surgery. But she tells it in a very emotional way, because really what we need from doctors or priests or friends is that capacity to be with us in our pain, in our difficulties. And she is a master storyteller. So she does that for us as well as readers. She stands with us in our own struggles and uncertainties and doubts and self-doubts. And a very loving writer. So anybody who's feeling the need for a hug or some insightful, I don't want to diminish her wisdom by this. I just want to stress that as brilliant as she is, she's even more loving. And that's not a small thing in a writer to feel that kind of heartfulness in her transmissions.
Hmm. You know, the interesting thing about your list, and it is a very interesting list, it seems that as though every single one of these books is a member of your family. You know, you talk about the aunt and Campbell as being your spiritual father, and
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. Yes, It feels that way. I make very strong connections with my writers, but this list in particular, I think they're all very emotional and vulnerable people. They show themselves as they are, so you don't feel you're reading somebody's ideas. You feel you're being invited into their lives, and that's what really happens through these books.
And the book that you were talking about earlier, The Landscapes, the title of that is Reclaiming the Wild Soul, How Earth's Landscapes Restore Us to Wholeness, Mary Thompson Reynolds. Is there anything more you want to say about that book?
That it's full of practices as well. It's not just the map that she drew, which is beautiful. It's actually a mandala of these different landscapes, and with affirmations that you can say to bring those energies closer to your life and to embody them. But aside from all that, there's very good practices chosen to embody these different qualities in ourselves. So that's a practical book.
So going back to your life journey, you were a journalist for many, many years, and I can imagine that it was a very rewarding job for you, and very stimulating too. And then you gave it up. Which of these books, or how many of these books, had something to do with that switch?
Oh, what a good question. I hadn't thought of that. And then there's several, really. Mary Oliver's poems certainly had a lot to do with it, because they brought me ever more into a more sensitive, soulful connection to life. And journalism, even though I was writing about very emotional topics, it was funny, because it's almost classic. What's the word I'm looking for? It's very transparent, the road I took as a journalist. I started out writing about politics, international politics, and then more and more, as I came closer to being who I am and allowing myself to be who I am, I started writing about softer and more emotional topics. And I ended up in the magazine for many years, in Sunday Magazine, writing about the things that I went. And then the last, I don't know, 5 years, I exclusively wrote about spirituality, which is something that newspapers don't normally cover. And I had the good fortune that I was allowed to write about dreams and archetypes and all of these things. So more and more, I was growing closer to these concerns and these interests, even within journalism. But then at some point, the tug was too strong. And it even just, even though I was writing about these topics, it was still from a journalist standpoint. So I was making questions, and I had to, it was very much a mental activity, and I needed to put my body into it. So I would say poetry, certainly, and Campbell as well, because that whole invitation to follow your bliss and to come closer to your true passions. But it was a difficult leap, because I was very much a journalist, and I had been a passionate one my whole life. So that was my identity for a long time. I remember calling people, and I would always say I worked for one of the two largest newspapers here. So it was easy to call somebody and say, I am so-and-so from Clarín, from this newspaper, and anybody would pick up the phone, and suddenly it was just me. You know, if I had to call somebody, there was nobody backing me up anymore. So it was quite a leap. But
And also to become a teacher.
Yes, that took a while. It's still kind of hard to say, to declare myself a teacher, even though I have many loving students, and it's been a while now. But you know how it is with when you change gears into a different identity, it's always a while until you can comfortably call yourself that. But I like to think of myself more of a guide you know, a companion in this road. But yes, I have many students that I love very much. Most of them end up becoming my friends because of the kinds of things that we share, which are so personal and so close to the bone for all of us. But it's been an interesting shift from writing to then embodying to then teaching. And it's a very hands-on practice for me. Not so much now that it's all online, but even so, I really try to keep it embodied, an embodied practice. When we were getting together face-to-face, we would prepare, I don't know, when we would explore nature, which is always part of my curricula, I would bring different herbs and we would make teas and medicinal products. And the senses are always there because I don't like things to get too intellectual. I like to keep them close to the heart and the body. So it's a very strange combination of practices that we do.
In your bio, you say that, you know, what you're doing is helping people understand themselves better and move towards, you know, who they really want to be, what they really want to do. How are you doing that?
That's another good question. I think maybe what I most try to do is to propose practices and ideas that bring us all alive. Because when you come alive, when something makes you come alive, you remember who you are, yes. What strikes the match in your heart. So a lot of the things we do are, I don't know, just to give you an example, last night we're working with mythic imagination at the moment. So what we did was draw a map, even online, you know, everybody, all parts of the world. But after a small, short visualization to bring us into that imaginative state of mind, I had them go out into the world, you know, in their imaginations and draw a mythic map of their neighborhood. You know, what's significant and what would you call that tree and what would you call that lamppost? And so almost as if you had your own little Narnia, you know, laid out in front of you. So people very quickly realize what it is that's alive for them. You know, what comes to my mind? Is it maybe it's something that's not even in my landscape right now? It's something from my childhood or some place that I would like to be. So all kinds of experiences always point to the same place, which is, what are you about? What makes you, what ignites you? What makes you feel?
Yeah. Yeah. That always fascinates me, is when you get to that little kernel in someone and all of a sudden, you know, they open up and they literally light up because they're in their passion. They've tapped into something that's really, you know, pivotal to who they are. And I think then, you know, I always call that the glamour principle, because when someone is in that state, they just become so attractive, you know. You can't not warm to them. Yeah.
That's a nice phrase. I like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you talk about your course called Be the Light. And that's exactly what people become when they're in their passion.
Right. Exactly. And the interesting thing is that all those passions can be so completely different and diverse. But all of them, when you listen to somebody, as you say, and who is in that place, it catches on, even if it's something very far removed from your normal interests. It opens up something in you as well, no matter what the person is talking about. So I do think this is something that in adulthood, for some reason, it's been kind of stomped out of us or bred out of us through school and civilization and everyday concerns. So I do think there's a need for a new kind of aliveness that was familiar to us as children and that we can regain pretty easily, actually. But if we don't specifically go there, then we miss it. You know, you can just become too concerned with less important things and miss out on what we're really here for.
Yeah, the seriousness of adulthood.
Yes.
And responsibility overtakes that incredible, you know, I love Jean Houston's phrase, the imaginal realm, you know, because that's where we live as children.
Right. Definitely. And as I said that, I just remembered, can I add an 11th book? Can I mention a book that didn't go to
not technically, no, but go ahead. Tell us what it is.
because I came across it afterwards. Otherwise, it might have gone in the list. It's a new book, and it's I was fascinated by it. It's called A Call to Further Becoming, and it's by Sue Brightman. And just let me tell you briefly, it ties in with what we were talking about. That's the reason I mention it, because she did a study of 100 women to describe what life after 50 can look like these days, from 50 to 70 something. Women are pioneering a new way of being in the world. This is especially about women, but I would say that it really pertains to all of us. And again, coming back to aliveness, we do need to know that nowadays, 50 or 60 or 70 is not an age for retirement, but of trying out new delights, new interesting things that we wanted to do. So this aliveness is very much an invitation up to the very, very end of our lives, whenever that may happen for each of us. So that's why I thought, I just thought of adding that in, because it's not a question of age. It's a question of decision, what you want to do, where you want to stand in your life.
Yeah. So tell us about where Wonder lives, practices for cultivating the sacred in your daily life.
Well, that book actually came out of one of my yearly courses that you mentioned at the beginning. I always give a different course every year, never repeat them. And this was one that took place a few years back. And it was so exciting, the whole path that we took, for me and I think for everybody that joined me there. So I decided to start writing about it. That's how it happened. And it became, there was a map, and that was a map that I followed with my students. Should I show it to you? Because I have it right next to me.
Sure. Please do.
This is the cover by a beautiful illustrator called Maite Ortiz. And the whole book is actually illustrated by her, and it's full of lovely drawings. And the map, let me see if I can quickly find and show you the map, is a map of 9 different stations. Here it is. So it's an imaginary map, imaginal, I should say, rather than imaginary.
Yes.
Of 9 stations, all of which contain different dimensions of life that are all inspiring when you go into them with an open heart and curiosity. So they're each represented by an element of nature mostly. So one is the mountaintop and another is the river. And then you have there's the lighthouse, which is the only one that's not, and the village, and then the ocean and the jungle. And each of them has to have to do with embodying different qualities and aspects of life that bring us alive and that remind us what a mystery and a marvel this experience is or could be. But that's not exempt of difficulties and challenges. So there's one specific station in the map, which is called the swamp, which is about shadow, psychological shadow, and how that comes up in our journeys always, and how that is also meant to teach us and to help us grow. So it's a map that you can enter for more ever. It's not a road map so much, because there's not a specific order. You can enter wherever you are attracted to do so, or wherever you feel the need. And basically there's a little explanation about what that station is about and what wisdom traditions have to say about it and contemporary thinkers have to say about it. But then it's mostly practices. How do you work with your shadow? How do you deepen your relationships with other people? How do you connect with nature in a very embodied and joyful way? How do you bring your senses to life? How do you quiet your mind? I'm sort of going through all of them now. How do you unfurl your imagination so that your life will be inspired and magical and enchanted? So all of these dimensions. And then there's one called the fire, which is about rituals and ceremonies and why we still need them today, even in the 21st century. It's quite a bit to take in.
I'm intrigued by the fact that you say you do not repeat a course ever. I mean, most people, they have a successful course and there you have the model and, you know, other people then hear about it and want it. But what you're saying is no. You know, if you don't get it the first time round, too late.
Right. Well, I guess that's the journalist in me. I would be bored to repeat something that I've already taught. I need to keep exploring. I need to keep moving. But of course, as I think Campbell said, one is always re-exploring the same 10 or 12 passions, and I'm no exception. So the courses are different. There's a different map. There's different ideas. And hopefully each topic is enriched by what I've read and experienced since the past course, the past year. But I do go back and back again to these topics that are my lifelong passion, spirituality and dreams and nature and archetypes and myths. All of that is always somehow or other present in my courses because these are the subjects and emotions. I'm very interested in emotions, and this is very much a developing science, and there's not too much consensus. So it's very exciting to be able to study emotions and see and piece together what you think makes most sense from the very diverse research there is out there. So no, I don't repeat courses. Sometimes people will write to me mid-year and will say, you know, I might as well wait until take it next year. And I'll say, no, there won't be a next year. I don't know what I'll be doing next year, but not this. So that's always the way it is. But there's always a next course, or there has been for many years now.
So you don't reach a place where you think, oh goodness, I don't have a course, you know, in mind for next year, and then suddenly, what am I going to do?
Every year around September, I think I've said all I had to say. This is it. I have to find a new profession. And magically, and I mean magically, around December, January, that's our year, because we go from March to December. And in our summer, which is January, February, suddenly it comes alive and I'm thinking, oh, no, there's this. I haven't explored this. But every year there's a moment in time when I say, how many more courses can I teach? This is it. It's funny. Now I recognize that in me, and I don't get upset. I know that in a few months when activity winds down and I'm quiet, something new will come knocking at my door, or at least I hope it will.
So of all the authors on your list, if you could had the opportunity to sit down, have tea, maybe interview, or just have, you know, a free-flowing conversation with them, which one would you pick?
Definitely Campbell. Definitely Campbell. Joseph. Because with Mary Oliver, I think I mentioned it in the review that I wrote, that I sent you. She was such a private person that I think I would have had a hard time knocking her door, even if I had had the chance. I know that she liked to be alone with her birds and her trees, and I just preferred to love her from a distance. But Campbell was, he was a talkative and he was a conversationalist, and he enjoyed sharing his wisdom. And something that is unusual and fortunate for me is that I have had the chance to have long and wonderful conversations with the man who did write the foreword, who is Brother David Steindl-Rast. Are you familiar with him?
No.
He's an amazing author himself, and he's a Benedictine monk who has written about gratitude. And I had the amazing fortune of meeting him in Argentina. He's been living here for a while. He comes and goes because he made good friends with an Argentine couple who've become like family to him. And he has met everyone because he's so illustrious himself, and he's 95 now. So many times talking to him, he gave some conferences with Campbell and with pretty much anybody you could mention. So he would say, oh, well, Joe, this and that, my friend Joe. So I feel through him that in a way, I have met Campbell. I asked him how was he in this way, and how did he react to this or that? And he has given me a little bit of an inside look. But if I had been able to have a conversation myself, that is definitely who I would have chosen to talk.
Yeah, I think I would too. Yeah, how could you not?
How could you not? Right.
How could you not? Yeah.
Engaging man, and so generous.
Yeah. Yeah. Fabiana, I mean, it's been fascinating hearing about your 10 best books, many of which I am not familiar with. I'm ashamed to say that, but I will certainly make sure that I am. Tell us where any viewers who want to know more about your work or your courses or your books can find out more about you.
Thank you. Well, my website is got my name on it, but I will spell it because it's not easy. It's Fabiana, is Fabiana. And my last name, Fondevilla, is Fondevilla. So it's www.fabiana.com. and then slash English. But if even if you don't write the English, when you get go in, you will see it. And you can leave your contact information there to receive my mailing list. And there I share my courses and articles and poems and whatnot. So that's a really good place to connect. And I have an ongoing, as you mentioned, year-long course, but in English, I'm doing it. It's once monthly instead of in the Spanish speaking world where I have a lot of more students, we do it weekly, but the English version is just a once a month. The first Saturday of each month, we go through the different stations of this other course called Be the Light, which is basically we're going around a house. The house is metaphor of the self. So we've been visiting the different spaces of the house. The kitchen is the emotions and the basement, which we were just in, is the imaginal realm and so on and so forth. So that'll go on for at least 5 or 6 sessions more, and people can join in whenever they'd like. I'd love to see them.
And Where Wonder Lives, I mean, it is the first of your books to be published in English by Inner Traditions. Do you have another one in the pipeline?
Yeah, I'm writing another one about aliveness, which is what we've been talking about. So it's a different map. But it's this time the flashlight, so to speak, is going looking in places where aliveness resides, which is very close to awe, but it's a different take on it. So I hope to have that by next year. I'm still in the middle of the writing, but thank you for asking.
Fabiana Fondavilla, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been delightful having this time with you and getting to know you.
Same here. It's been amazing. And then thank you for your very interesting questions. You really made me think.
Good. And thank you at home for joining us. And if you want to see any previous videos in this series, you can go to our YouTube channel, as well as the video page at the No BS Spiritual Book Club.com. That's it for this week. We will be back at the same time next week with another episode of Face to Face with for the No BS Spiritual Book Club. Thank you. Bye-bye.